Greetings and welcome to another episode of the Faithful Presence Podcast. I am your host, Michael Langer, ordained minister and founder of Faithful Presence. Since 2021, a ministry in Washington, D.C., equipping servants and leaders working in our nation's capital to flourish as they participate in Christ's mission of making all things new through providing spiritual, emotional, relational, vocational, ideological, cultural, and evangelical discipleship, and by supporting the local church in equipping their members for Christ-centered participation in and with the public square. It is so good to be back with you. This past weekend, my wife and I celebrated our 33rd wedding anniversary. We had a nice dinner. We went out to listen to some live music with friends out at Death Ridge Brewery, a place in Northern Virginia that my wife and I love to go. And as amazing and wonderful and celebratory as our anniversary is, Friday was also the day that Tim Keller passed away. For those of you who are familiar with Tim Keller, he is a larger than life, if that's actually possible, but he's a very large figure in the evangelical Christian church. He and I serve in the same denomination. He planted a church in New York City back in the late 80s, and that church, Redeemer Presbyterian Church, has grown and has influenced the way not just pastors, but churches and also Christians have seen their way to engaging culture, to participating in the world, to living life, to proclaiming the excellencies of the one who called us out of darkness and into his marvelous light. In other words, he has encouraged generations, maybe two whole generations of individuals, to live in a posture of faithful presence. So what we want to do on this episode, I want to share with you it's basically a seminar that was given by Dr. Keller back in probably the late 90s. And here's how I would set this up for you. Dr. Keller planted a church in Hopewell, Virginia in the late 70s and was there until the mid 80s, where he left to go be a professor at Westminster Theological Seminary. And from there, he went to plant Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City. And while he was there, the denomination that I'm a part of, the Presbyterian Church in America, used Tim Keller and would fly him around, along with some other church planters, to train church planters in how to church plant so that they weren't just trying to figure it out on their own. And here's how, kind of, I would say, here's how Tim Keller and I intersected. I had no idea who Dr. Keller was when I showed up at Covenant Seminary in 2004. But during that first semester, Dr. Keller came and gave a sermon and handed us out an outline of a book that would basically become his classic, The Reason for God. It's just an apologetic masterpiece. I would commend it to you. And his approach to engaging ideological conversations, cultural conversations, vocational conversations, missional conversations so impacted me at that point that a seed was planted that eventually led me in 2006 to go to church planting assessment, where I was, along with my wife, was vetted for church planting and was later approved as a church planter. And so in 2008, I left St. Louis and planted a church in my hometown of Iowa City, Iowa. And at some point in that first year, somebody gave me a CD. This is the old way of transmitting information. Somebody gave me an actual digital disc. And on it was written this, the Tommy Tapes. And the Tommy Tapes are named after a friend of mine, Tommy Allen, who's an Evangelical Presbyterian Church, EPC church planter out in Seattle. And he had been present and participating in this church planter training with Dr. Keller back in the 90s. And somehow somebody had recorded this and it made its way into my hands. And for the next, I would say for the next 15, 16 years, I've kind of been the keeper of the Tommy tapes, and I have shared them with anybody who wants them because they are gold when it comes to how do we have a conversation with people that we are trying to influence for Christ, try to win to Christ, and to give them, I would say, to give them foretastes of the goodness of the kingdom of God that includes very resilient ideological thinking on a vast variety of topics. So what you are about to hear is about an hour and 15 minutes, a stream of highly honed apologetic consciousness where Dr. Keller moves from Camus to Cornelius Van Til to Andy Warhol to Oz Guinness. He talks about modernism and postmodernism, avant-garde art, meta-narratives, identity politics, the gender debates, how ideological constructs and the way that we perceive knowledge and truth has influenced political ideologies and political solutions to issues like housing projects, like Cabrini Green, educational systems, all myriad of present debates that we are having as a country are, I would say, both encapsulated and predicted and discussed in depth in this conversation that took place, like I say, in the late 1990s, probably 98, 99. Now, at the end of this, I will tell you that Dr. Keller enters into a Q&A portion of this seminar. And while some of the questions are inaudible, the answers are still gold and worth trying to muddle through the questions that we can't hear. I will tell you that the majority of this is really aimed or supposed to be aimed at pastors, but the content is so wonderful that it is applicable to basically anyone who not only considers themselves to be a Christian, but desires to share their faith with others and desires to make a difference in this world, that desires to join in Christ's mission of making all things new. So at the end of the podcast, I'll come back. I'll just give you a couple parting thoughts. So enjoy this wonderful seminar from Dr. Tim Keller, who passed away on Friday.
That's it.
Thanks. Could you turn in your notebooks to a kind of a long handout, which I was going to cover half of tonight and half of tomorrow night, because I get tonight and tomorrow night to do this. Reaching the Secular Person, and it's in, the notebook's not that thick at this point yet, so you ought to be able to find it. I don't know where it is, but it's in the middle. See where it says Reaching the Secular Person? And there's really three parts to it. The first couple of pages I want to spend time on tonight. I want to talk about what a secular person is, or what do we mean by a secular mindset. And Preston's already made some references to what I'm going to say. That's great. Raise some questions in your mind that I can answer. That's a wonderful way of setting me up. And once we look at that, and we talk about what is a secular person, what is it going to mean in the future, the near future, to a minister to people who are secular, and that's not something in the American scene we've really had to deal with until recently. Once we ask, we sort of look at that for a minute, I'm going to stop at that point and try to take questions, because I'm sure that what I'm going to say is a bit sketchy there, and it's going to be sketchy. Then after that, I want to spend time looking at two things. Tonight, what are the implications for the way in which we do ministry? I call that form, ministry form. And tomorrow night, what are the implications of that for the way, for the content of our ministry? Not the form of the content. The form is how we do it. The content is what we're saying. In other words, as we see America becoming, we're getting to the place eventually where the average person will be secular. We haven't really had to deal with that before. What does it mean? What are the implications of that for form and our content? Tonight form, tomorrow content. Roughly, that means I'll cover about 10 of these pages tonight and 10 of these tomorrow night. In 1959, David Martin Lloyd-Jones wrote preached a series of sermons on revival in London. And Britain and Europe saw this coming way before we did. But he kind of gives an illustration. He was a doctor, and he often thinks medically. He said, it used to be, that the way in which you would have a revival in our country is you would go to the people of your community, one way or the other, people who maybe were not in church, and you'd essentially, in your preaching, you'd look at them and you'd say, you know better. You know what you should be doing. And they did. And he says, basically, the way you would get a revival going was you would rouse them. You would, you know, blow on the dying embers of what they knew. They had a conscience. They understood. They had the same basic moral framework, the same basic cosmology as the Christians. He says, that's not the situation anymore. His first sermon was on the place where in Mark 9, where the apostles, the disciples, were trying to cast a demon out of a boy. And they obviously had been casting demons out successfully, because they were very perplexed that this one wouldn't come out. And Jesus comes up and says, this kind only comes out through particular prayer and fasting, and then he cast it out. Lloyd-Jones' point in the sermon was, there's demons and there's demons. There's that kind, and then there's this kind. The disciples' old approaches were fine, but not with this kind. Now he says, then he suddenly went to a kind of medical illustration. You're walking along a road and you suddenly see a man who's clearly unconscious laying in the road, and there's cars coming, traffic coming. So he says, what are you going to do about it? He says, it really depends on just how unconscious the person is. If the person has fallen asleep, all you have to do is you have to yell or maybe shake him, and then he'll cooperate with you. It won't be that hard. I mean, you run together away. Say, look, there's a truck coming. How can you fall asleep here? And you go, oh, and off you go. So you rouse him. It doesn't take a whole lot. He says, what on the other hand if the man's got a, what if he's sick? What if he's got a fever? He's passed out. You know, what if he's had a stroke? He says, then to get the man to safety is a lot more complex, and he's not going to be able to help you very much. He says, that's the situation we're in now. And he says, I think I have a quote of his on the, don't look at this, I'll get to it later. He says, in the sermon, he says, today, in our situation here in Britain, it is no longer merely a question of immorality. This has become an amoral or a non-moral society, not an immoral society. The very category of morality isn't recognized. He says, you can't say to people now in Britain, you know better. You know what you ought to do. You can't go after them and sort of blow on the dying ember. There's nothing there to blow on. You just blow ashes in your face. Now, that's 1959 in Britain. That is not what it was like in America in 1959, and I'm not even sure quite that it's that way now. I believe that we've overblown the idea that the baby boomers, that's me, 75 million people in and around me, I'm 44, and you know, 6 or 7 years below me and 6 or 7 years above me is the baby boomers. The baby boomers are supposedly secular, and they are in this sense. They were all raised in a church. Virtually all of us are raised in a church. But now, something like 40% of us don't go to church. Now, that's a real movement. There's never been a generation that did that. 40, 50, even more than that, something like that. So we're the first generation that's moved away from church, but we were raised in church. There's still embers in us. We have highly traditional instincts, and you can see that now depends on who you're reading. There's like half of the baby boomers that left. I remember reading in the American Demographics not too long ago, they roughly said probably 2/3 of baby boomers left the faith that the churches that they were raised in. 2/3, and about 1/3 stayed, and now at least half. But nobody knows. There's a lot of debate about this. But at least half of the people who left are starting to come back, you know, as they're starting to either get older and feel death coming on, or have children and feel the need for moral grounding for the kids and so on. The point I'm making is that the secularity of our generation is fairly superficial. But we have set up, just like Preston set me up, we have set up the next generation. because the baby boomers who are now in charge of the cultural institutions are deeply secular, and they are training up a new generation of people who are a vast number of them, vaster than any American generation ever, are being raised in broken homes and in homes where there really isn't any particular religious tradition at all. So the deeper secularism that Lloyd-Jones was talking about, he says it's right at our doorstep now, we're getting to it now here in 1960 in Britain, is, I think, on our doorstep now in America. I see the Becks over here. Canada would be somewhere in the middle. I mean, not maybe as bad as Europe, not as good as America, depending on how you look at it. But in other words, this thing has been moving, and we're at the brink of it now. What is it? Now, Preston used the word postmodern, and what I'm going to do is I'll bite. I'll do that. I'm going to say there's an older kind of secularism, my parents' kind of secularism. By the way, not that my parents are secular, my own tape. Sorry, Mom, Dad, I didn't mean that. But there's my parents' version of secularism, the kind of secularity that I saw my parents' generation, they were mainline Protestant-type people. They were basically deists, right? That's the kind of, the older unbelief was deism. People believed in God, and they believed in a right and wrong, and they believed that reason and science could discover a lot of good things. And they believed that there was a right and wrong, and the Ten Commandments were good things. They didn't believe in miracles. They probably didn't believe in certainly didn't believe in being born again. That was old fundamentalism. We got rid of that. But there was a kind of, that's the older secularism, the older unbelief, still fairly proper, still pretty moral in its instincts, still allied with Christianity in a lot of ways. There is a truth. There are absolutes. There really is such a thing as human nature. We really can. There's such a thing as truth and justice and mercy, and we ought to work on these things. But the secularity of my children's generation, and by the way, kids, I'm not saying you're secular either, but I'm saying the secularity of my children's generation is far deeper. My kids are 17; they're in their teens. Very different than the kind of secularity and unbelief of my parents' generation. And as Preston's saying, we've got to get ready for the deeper secularity. Now, you can call it postmodernism. I will sometimes. You can call it hypermodernism if you want to. It doesn't matter. I'm going to describe the old and the new, the older and the newer and deeper kind of secularity and belief that's coming, that Lloyd-Jones says is more like a person who's had a stroke spiritually than a person who's asleep. Now, having said that, let's take a look at the text a little bit. Let me give you a. I'll put it this way. I'll just say a couple things in summary before I open it up. The older unbelief did not completely reject authority. It did reject the authority of the Bible and a special revelation. It said we have to have freedom of thought. If you read any of the interesting stuff coming out now, George Marsden and other people are writing about how American universities all went from being religious to being secular, and a big part of that was the process was usually through a call for academic freedom, and the call for academic freedom was freedom of thought. But the old secularity simply said, we don't want to be under the authority of the Bible. We don't want religious dogmatists telling us what we have to believe. But they did believe there was a truth. They wanted to be free to submit, though, to the authority of reason and empirical investigation. They wanted to be able to use their mind. They wanted to use the tools of rationality and empirical investigation to find the truth. What are human beings really like? We don't want to learn it from the Bible. They resisted the authority of the Bible and the authority of special revelation, but they didn't completely resist authority, because they still believed they were seekers after truth, capital T. We're going to find out, we're not going to go to the Bible, we're going to find out through science what human nature is really like, what people are really like, what really causes poverty, what really causes depression. We're going to find out. So they still, in a sense, believed that there needed to be, there was an authority. They still believed in the authority of reason. But today, postmodern, hypermodern, the deeper secularity, doesn't believe in authority of any kind, and because they don't believe in absolutes of any kind, because they don't believe in truth of any kind. They don't believe there is anything out there that we have to submit to, and anybody saying such is being oppressive. I think until I moved to New York, I used to write off the avant-garde artistic fringe people as just loonies. You know, you used to say, oh gosh, there it is. Look at that. That's art. And you know, you can laugh at it. And I begin to realize, however, that the fine arts, even and especially the craziest kinds of fine arts, are usually ahead of the time, but they're showing where the culture is going. A great example of postmodern art was a lady named Sherry Levine, who a couple years ago, she's a photographer, so what she did was she went to a number of galleries and she took pictures of extremely famous pictures. And then she had her own showing. And of course she was taking pictures of these famous pictures. A lot of people said, that's plagiarism. She says, I took these pictures. My own camera. I went to a place and I took a picture of something that was out there in the world. And what she said, and what all the culture critics who loved it said, this is great, end quote, this is an assault on the idea of the rights of authorship. What she was trying to say, she says, I'm assaulting the very idea that the author has any rights at all. And the whole idea, maybe what some of you have heard the word deconstruction, the idea behind deconstruction is it's this particular approach to life applied to literature. And this approach to life says that it is oppressive for anyone to say that the text means what the author said it to mean. That's oppressive to me. It means what I say it means. When I read anything, it's what I say it means. That's what she was doing. She was assaulting the very idea of authority from which you get, you know, the word author's in there. It's oppressive, she said, to tell me that this is what it has to mean, this is what the poem means because the author said so. There is no such thing as truth. There is no such thing as meaning. I make my own. Now, I mean, this is a deeper thing. This is a deeper kind of unbelief. And, but you know, even today I went into the Richmond Airport, and on my way in, there was a sign that said, it was incredible. It said, 5 ways that you can park, you know, long-term, short-term, this, your choice. You know, 30 years ago, you will park these ways and only these ways, you see, but not now. In other words, your choice. We would never want to tell you how to park, but we give you these 5 choices. It's up to you. It's totally up to you. You know, I just last night on the on a cable channel, at the top, you know, they're showing you what's playing, and it's a scroll down channel, I call it. At the top, they were trying to get you to read a book. It was, have you seen the ad for Romeo and Juliet? It starts off saying, you fall in love, your parents say he's no good for you, she's no good for you. Then you find out she isn't really any good for you. Then you want to kill yourself. Does it sound familiar? And then it says, Romeo and Juliet by Shakespeare. It says, read a book. You'll find yourself in a book. Never read a book. It'll tell you about the good. It'll tell you about the truth. It'll elevate you. No, you'll find yourself in the book. You know, when the movie Panther came out, when the movie JFK came out, even when Pocahontas came out, and a lot of critics said, you know, that's not the way it really was. What the people who did the movie said is, well, you know, for years, and they're right, see, here's the problem. For years, all the Indians were bad in all the movies. Now, all the Indians are going to be good. Of course it's a fiction. So was the original idea of a fiction. There is no such thing as truth. History is written by the winners. We're in a position where we're going to write history the way we want to write it. You see, there really is no clear line between truth and fiction. This is very different. The old kind of unbelief, the old kind of secularism, was very, very anti the Bible and the idea of supernatural revelation. But it believed that there was such a thing as truth, and it was extremely rational. The new is very different, extremely different. So let me show you a couple of ways of putting this. I'm going to put it back and forth for the next 10 minutes, and then I'll stop and make sure you're with me, okay? Look at the older, newer secularism at the top of the first page. Earlier in this century, skeptics rejected Christianity because they said it wasn't true. Today they reject it because it even claims to be true. Okay? That's very different. It used to be they rejected Christianity because you claim to be true, but we've found out that it's irrational, you know, it doesn't make sense. You can't prove it. Today, it's the very fact that Christianity claims to be true that is the cause for rejection. It used to be Christianity was ruled out because miracles can't be. Today it's ruled out because absolutes can't be. So I put down here, The old, I'm calling it modernity, the older unbelief said that moral absolutes can be discovered by human reason and research. The newer secularism says there's no such thing. The older secularism said that science and reason could find public truth and only science and reason. Public truth means a truth that you could publicly appeal to for public policies that everybody had to agree in. If I believe something, because the Bible said so, that's private, that's not something you can appeal to me to do. But if I say science has proven that smoking's bad for your health, that research has shown that smoking's bad for your health, therefore we should, you know, forbid smoking. That was okay, that's public truth because it's based on reason. The newer secularism is going to undermine that completely because it says, frankly, that there's no public truth, that all there is except relativism, the freedom for every group to discover their own truth. The newer secularism really completely undermines the idea of science, doesn't believe that science is objective either. And there's, you know, there's a point to that, half a point. Van Til gave it to us a few years ago, and now they see it as the whole point. But as I put down here, intellectuals used to be open to absolutes and closed to miracles. Now they're completely open to miracles and closed to absolutes. You know, the deeper secularism would never say miracles can't happen, never, because that's oppressive to say such a thing. That's the oppression of reason. Okay. And so that's the older and newer secularism. Now, I heard Preston even talk about relativism. There's an older and a newer relativism. Until fairly recently, when I was a college kid, in a sense, you know, everybody differs about this. I'm not giving you an intellectual history. Where did the older secularism start to get squeezed out by the newer? It all depends, you know, who you're reading. But in the 60s, when I was in college, there was a very, very, very popular movement called existentialism. And existentialism was probably the beginning, overt beginning of it. When I went to college, I had to read, it was terrible. In Religion 101, I had to read The Rebel by Camus. In Philosophy 101, I had to read The Rebel by Camus. In History 101, I had to read it was wonderful in some ways, you know, one book. But they were the first ones to start to say, look, there isn't any meaning we're going to discover through reason. Life is absurd. And what they said is, you have to individually construct your own meaning and your own right and wrong to be authentic. Those of you remember that, I imagine. However, today's postmodernity is deeper than that. This is very important to understand, I think, right here. So I'll just read through it. It's also led by French thinkers, by the way. It teaches that all concepts of truth and morality are not just individually constructed. That was pretty naive. It actually makes a little more sense. They say all concepts of truth and morality are socially constructed by groups or communities. So here's a couple representative quotes. No set of cultural beliefs can claim logical superiority over another set because all such beliefs are motivated by subjective interests. What's the subjective interest? Groups weave stories or narratives to give themselves meaning and identity. This is the idea. You know, when you talk about truth and values and meaning, your group needs to have stories that give your group a kind of identity, give your group meaning. But all truth claims are fictional stories. And they work for you as a group, that's why you have them. The purpose now of scholarship or politics or art or philosophy and even science is not to try to find absolutes that are true for everybody. That would be violent. But to empower groups to find their own voice, their own sets of symbols and values. That's the reason why in the thinking and the writing of these folks, truth is always in quotation marks, and even facts are in quotation marks. So here's another example. Postmodernism signals the death of meta-narratives. What's a meta-narrative? That's a story that any group says this is true for everybody. It's a meta-narrative. Notice they won't even talk about truth. A narrative is a story that you're trying to put forth as a truth. And all meta-narratives are secretly terroristic. Its function is to ground and legitimate the illusion of a universal human history. We now are in the process of awakening from the nightmare of modernity. The nightmare that said, you know, and we're not talking about Christianity, he's not talking about Christianity, he's talking about the older approach that said, through science and reason, we can find out what's wrong. See, well, I'll give you an example in a minute. The older modern approach said, we have to get to the bottom of poverty. We have to figure out why people are poor. And we can do this through social science. And once we figure that out, we can, through the application of social sciences to education, to government, and so on, we can ameliorate poverty. See, that's modern. That's not postmodern. Postmodernity says there isn't such a thing. In fact, as soon as you do that, and they can make a great case, I'll show you why Christianity, you know, Christians had alliances with modern people, and it's going to have alliances with postmodern people. They're right, by the way in which the modern state has dealt with poverty in the last 50 years using the older approaches has been pretty bad. So, we're now in the process of awakening from the nightmare of modernity with its manipulative reason and fetish of totality into the laid-back pluralism of the postmodern. See, so let me give you some couplets. The modern approach, it's not on the sheet for a minute. The modern approach said the world makes sense. The postmodern approach says it doesn't. The modern approach in art wanted purpose and design. Remember the old abstract art? Remember abstract art? You say, what do you mean, remember abstract art? See, abstract art was the idea of rational, putting. It was rational art, pure form, pure color, not representational art anymore. Not, you know, actually painting landscapes or pictures of people, but pure form and pure design, pure line or a pure color and so forth. But then you have Andy Warhol, who comes along and starts giving you representative art again. You know, Marilyn Monroe and Campbell soup cans, but it's meaningless. It means nothing. Modern art, purpose and design. Postmodern art, play and chance. Modern art, form. Postmodern art, collages. Eclecticism, just sticking things together randomly. The modern, emphasis on the product. The postmodern, emphasis on the process. The modern, the emphasis on the moral values. The postmodern, of course, says that there are no moral values, and anybody who says there are moral values is not just misguided, but you are hurting me. It's a terrorism. You're trying to get your group over my group. The moderns was out for the essence. What's the essence of dogness? What makes a dog a dog? See, you know, that's the modern was after depth and essence. The postmodern was only concerned with surface and style. Why? Because your identity is constructed by you. There isn't an essence. That's where the word existentialism came from. It's existencism. That you are precedes what you are. Existence precedes essence. That was the old existentialism, and that's the foundation for the newer secularism. Depth as opposed to surfaces and image. That's the reason why you're going to see as the future goes on, there is far more emphasis on how you look, far more emphasis on style, far more emphasis on surfaces, far more emphasis on polish. The modern was after boundaries. Where does this start and this stop? The postmodern is all after connections. The modern was after hierarchy. The postmodern is after anarchy, you know. The modern is after lots and lots of layers. The postmodern is as much as possible to have everything on a horizontal relationship. Now, is this? Look at the top of the page. Truth is socially constructed by those in power. Therefore, there's multiple changeable truths, quote unquote. You know what? One of the postmodern flags that are waved around is everyone is in drag. Have you heard that? Everyone is in drag. What was drag? Drag, of course, is men dressed as women. But you know, you want to know the reason why female impersonation is far more... have you noticed how it used to be you only occasionally saw any of this, but now it's mainstream practically. It's everywhere. There's celebrities. Because it waves a flag for postmodernism. That is, you really create, or groups of people around you tell you who you are. You become whoever... You are what you dress. You are... what you decide to be. You are what your groups decide you to be. Everybody's in drag. Everybody's creating an identity. There is no essence. Everything is surface. There is no depth. There's no essential principles. There's only contextual concepts. There's no inner essence. There's only surface of the image. There's no grand narrative. There's multiple storylines. We don't have reality. We don't have virtual reality. Now, what does this do to Christianity? I'm going to try to move over a little bit into, all right, what does that mean for us? Admittedly, I live in New York City, and if you live in New Haven, New York City, Toronto, places like that, a lot of this sounds a lot more, makes a lot more sense. If you live in California, it's not, I'm not saying that this is everywhere yet, but nevertheless, you have to start asking yourself, is this good or bad for Christians? And the answer is, by and large, bad. Okay, I think, by and large. But there's a lot of good things about it. Good example. Let me give you an example of this. We could ally with modern people and have a government. In fact, if you want to go back far enough, modernity, is since the Enlightenment, the American Revolution was an alliance, of Christians and deists, who at least could agree that there was a God and there were moral absolutes. So you could kind of get together. Oz Guinness's whole book, The American Hour, which is so hard to read. It took me forever. Have anybody tried to read the book? It's a great book. One of the things it says in there is that the Christians and the old modern people who are unbelievers, there was enough in common understanding about right and wrong, about what morality was, that you essentially could have a culture without a culture war. Believers and unbelievers were not in a culture war. Believers and unbelievers, Thomas Jefferson was no believer. He was very hostile to the gospel, and he was able to, mix it up with the evangelicals because he basically wanted roughly analogous kinds of culture and society that the evangelicals wanted. So in that sense, it's with postmodern unbelievers, it's very, very different. Very different because of identity politics. With postmodern believers, you have a culture clash, a terrible clash. You can't believe anything is wrong. It's not enough to say, I believe homosexuality is wrong, but I want to be, I want you to know that as a homosexual I can treat you with respect. That's not good enough because your very belief that it's wrong is oppressive. It's seen as oppressive. So it's very, in some ways, we've got a lot of troubles. Now I'll just show you a couple ways in which it's not so bad. The modern approach to poverty was this is not a spiritual problem. This is strictly a social problem, strictly. And therefore, the way the poor were warehoused by modernity was huge projects were built for them, Huge, impersonal, ugly, modern buildings, right? They were all warehoused in there. They were put, they were taken out of their homes because they were considered shabby and they were given all these places. They were warehoused, and pretty much everybody realizes the housing projects, the modern approach is stupid. What is the postmodern approach? Not you say, well, this is what Christians are doing. Yeah, but you see, postmodern approach but also says poverty is complex. It's both personal and social. Poor people need to be given their own home. And instead of it being big and impersonal, it ought to be, have its own character. They ought to take part in the sweat equity. The Habitat for Humanity, the whole approach is very postmodern. Postmodern non-believers will say, this is great. Modern non-believers would say, this is terrible, this isn't rational, this isn't scientific. It's not done through a centralized bureaucracy and so forth. So there's certain ways in which, I'll give you another great example of this. The fact that the Supreme Court is now and will continue to make it harder and harder for religious groups and religious speech to be pushed out of public schools, you see the trend, don't you? More and more the courts are saying that if you allow any other group to rent an elementary school, a public elementary school, you can't discriminate against a religious group. More and more they're going to say, if you can say this and this and this and this in a school, you should be able to say something about religion. You can't discriminate against religious speech. That's the postmodern trend. The old approach, of course, was religious speech is not public truth. It shouldn't have anything to do with it. We're going to talk about science. The postmodern approach is nothing's objective. There is no truth. Therefore, everybody has the right to get up in a public school or a private school, wherever, and hold forth. And that's going to make it easier for church planners to rent public schools. That's a postmodern trend. So I'm just trying to say it's not all awful, but by and large, it is. And here's why. Look here, where it says older and newer hostility to Christianity, and then I'm done with the first part here. As a result of all this, there's a newer, deeper opposition by the unbelieving world. I do think it's newer and deeper to the Christian church and faith. Go down here. Those who claim to have a meta-narrative, a story that is true for all, are now seen as just trying to get power for their group over others. That's very different. The older skeptics pitied Orthodox Christians as outdated and laughable. The new skeptics think we're very dangerous. They expected that. The older skeptics expected as humanity became more scientifically sophisticated, the need for religion would die out. That's not the way we're seen now. The very claim of absolute truth has got to stop. And therefore, it's really a new situation coming down. Look at the third paragraph. This confronts the preacher of historic Christianity with an unprecedented communication obstacle. And we've always had something called relativism. We never had an age completely captured at the heart. This is the amoral society. Second paragraph. The main battleground for Christian teaching will not be the resurrection in the future. Everybody will say, no fooling, resurrected, wow. You know, nobody's going to say, impossible. You know, Matthew Arnold, you know, a good 19th century British guy, Matthew Arnold, has this great statement. This is the modern mindset. He says, miracles cannot happen. Therefore, miracles have not happened. That's great, right? And that's why he dismissed Christianity. You know, he says, you can show me all the evidence you want. Miracles cannot happen. Therefore, miracles have not happened. You're not going to hear them say that anymore. They're going to say, oh yeah, miracles? No kidding. Good. Let's have one now. But the problem will be, the sticking point will be the uniqueness of Christ. That'll be the problem. That he's the only begotten Son. Especially that he's the only way. They will take your head off more and more. You think it's bad now. It's nothing like it was. It's very interesting that the old, and maybe, again, Preston might have been alluding to this, you know, the old evidence that demands verdict books, the old books, used to have a tremendous amount of pages on, you know, the problem, you know, on how do you know Jesus was raised from the dead. And there might be a little bit at the back on questions of, you know, why does God allow suffering and why is Jesus the only way to God? Just a couple of things. Those are much bigger issues now than the resurrection or the miracles or even to some degree, the historicity of the Bible. I already mentioned the fact that it's spreading, the way I said, it spreads sort of from Europe to America. It's spreading, you know, from generation to the generation. I put down here in America, the deeper secularism is moving from coast to the heartland, from the educated classes to the less educated, through TV. Television, you see, books may be bad or good. Television may be bad or good, but as a medium, books make you rational, TV doesn't. Books make you keep an attention, it requires an attention span, it requires sequential thinking, and it requires thinking in context. If you watch TV, you know, you'll see bites, surfaces, images, and you can't tell the news really from the fiction, and that you really can't tell. And so the very mode of TV pushes you toward the idea of who knows what is real, who knows what is true after all. So just the very medium of television moves you toward a postmodern thinking. So it's moving from the educated to the less educated through TV, from the cultural elites to the next generation through the academia, and of course, especially through the popular culture channels. So in a sense, it's mainly on the way. Turn over to the top of the next page, and then let me take some questions. See the summary? Oh, I put down here, the best way to get ready for the future is to do evangelism with college students. Those of you I would have to say college students on the coasts. I don't want to sound chauvinistic or in any kind of way, If you deal with the very smartest college students at the very so-called best colleges on the coasts, then you really see this for what it is. It just things that you think should be arguments just don't compute. That's the reason why Preston was talking about, you know, his life in New Haven, and it's a little like Alice in the Looking Glass, but it's not going to be confined to that. no conscience, no sense of guilt. When I was a college student, there was an idealism which was very modern, really, in spite of the fact we were a mixture, an odd mixture of the existentialism coming in. Most of us sort of picked up, I think, most of my generation, because they wanted to have sex, picked up whatever popular philosophy would let you do it. That's not the same thing as having a completely changed, reoriented, renovated way of worldview. I don't think so. I think baby boomers wanted to have sex, and so they found some, you know, kind of philosophy 101 things that enabled them to justify their behavior, but down deep they're pretty traditional people. But what happens is if you, we wanted to change the world. Now this generation not only doesn't want to change the world, doesn't need to change the world, doesn't know what in the world, whose world would you want it to be? Your world, my world? So. Okay, Christian, both reason and revelation give us public truth. Modern said only reason, not revelation, gives us public truth. Postmodern says neither reason nor revelation give us public truth. There isn't any such thing. Now, we'll do, after I've taken some questions here, I'll get into what the implications of that for form, and then next tomorrow night content. Obviously, I can go as fast as I need to go, I think. Let's take some questions and make sure we're all together, and I'll move from right to left. Okay? Yeah, go ahead. I don't know your name. Either of you at that table, whatever order. Yes, sir.
So much of what we believe does become acculturated to do well.
Yes.
How do we maintain that kind of distinction that will not allow us to turn our culture off? I guess I'm just thinking in just classic terms because it's easier to think that way, i.e., let's say race.
Yes.
Socially, we are, I mean, we're very clear what we mean by that. Mm-hmm. It's scientifically unproven. Every sociologist knows that, anthropologist, but yet we're very clear. So there is, from a cultural standpoint, some things that we're very clear about. Mm-hmm. In our socially defined that we react to as believers.
Example? Give me an example.
In terms of, I don't know.
I know, I was, but go ahead. Can't you give me a relatively innocuous one?
Okay. I just got into a piece of
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. Say, no, in wrath, remember mercy. Yes. Right. There is grace. Go ahead.
You know, the whole thing, you know, like I've heard some, you know, affirmative action.
Yeah.
Republicanism.
Right.
You hear some, not anybody in this room, but some talk as if this is out of the throes of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying, that's your culture.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, it's based on biblical principle, and I'm saying, no,
good.
It's not. That's your culture.
Great. Yeah, you're great.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, you see, what I was, one of the good things about, I really wasn't being facetious when I say that there was a lot of good that came out of modern unbelief. The emphasis on science has really improved healthcare and improved our lives a great deal. There's no doubt about it. I think the good thing about postmodernism is it's extremely sensitive to cultural differences, and it does something called deconstruction. Now, what deconstruction is it goes after people who are saying in the name of principle and in the name of truth, I am doing this, but they, underneath they see it's just their way of accruing their own power. And the fact is that does happen. Now, if Christians aren't willing to admit that, and if Christians aren't willing to admit where they move beyond strictly what the Bible says and they're reading the Bible with their cultural blinders, if Christians don't show a certain amount of what my old professor up in Gordon Conwell, Richard Lovelace, used to call disenculturation. He says a Christian has to be able to be humble enough to see where a lot of the things he might have been reading in the Bible, he was reading through his own cultural blinders. Unless Christians are able to be critical of their own culture and their own political party, you know, and use the Bible against themselves, unless the Christians show that kind of humility, Postmodern people are extremely, extremely sensitive, rightly so, to power plays under the guise of principle. You know, I can see it with my kids. I can see with my kids when my children, I got three boys, they're kind of close together, and they love to find ways of getting a leg up on the other person. And they basically might say, the principle is that I should not have to sit in the back seat one more time. And yet it's not a matter of principle. You can see that he's been irritated with his little brother all week. And he's just trying to find any excuse he possibly can just to rub the kid's nose in. And even though he's technically right, his motivations are very wrong. It's a power play. I mean, I've been on vacation, so I've been deconstructing my children's approaches all week to each other. So you're absolutely right. Unless postmodern people are very, very sensitive to folks who actually do the Pharisees thing. And the Pharisees thing is they elevate the traditions of a human tradition and they bring it up to the same position as a biblical principle. That's Phariseeism. Postmodern people will smell Phariseeism a mile away. That's why I'm going to get to that later. So I think you're absolutely right. Now, notice right now we're not getting very detailed because I know there'd be a lot of differences of opinion about what is cultural and what is biblical. But unless we admit that there is a difference and unless we're willing to be very self-critical and be careful about being touchy about that, we're going to be eaten alive because postmodern people will read hypocrisy in us. Yes, okay, go ahead.
How does this insistence that there are no absolutes relate to Romans chapter 1? The insistence that, I have no conscience, everything is okay, whatever I figure out today, and I really know nothing, how does that relate to Romans chapter 1? Is that...
Romans chapter 1 is about idolatry. I would say Shirley MacLaine, when she says, "You're God, I'm God, we're all God," there's no doubt that this if there's no absolutes, that makes you God. This, right? God can do whatever he wants. We can do whatever we want. In other words, God doesn't do things because they're good. They're good because it's God and that kind of thing. So to a certain degree, I would say it does relate to Romans 1. And it's a pretty virulent form of idolatry where you're setting yourself up. Yes?
Just to clarify a little bit, particularly when it says they knew God. I'm not disagreeing. I'm just trying to understand. Where it says they knew God, and then right in the last verse, they know that those who practice such things are in deep trouble.
Right.
And with the people with no conscience,
No, it just sleeps a lot deeper. I mean, the guy's unconscious. He's not asleep. He's had a stroke, but he's not dead. I mean, there's no doubt that the knowledge of God, I didn't mean to say the knowledge of God is gone. I mean, you're right. The metaphors, of course, this is the trouble with rhetoric. The metaphor sounded like the knowledge of God's gone, but it's not. It can't go. It's just sleeping a whole lot deeper. That's the problem, getting to it, confronting people with it. What Lloyd-Jones was trying to say is that the knowledge of God in the past has slept much closer to the surface than people, and you could get to it, and now it's sleeping a whole lot deeper. And that's why this kind takes prayer and fasting and deeper things.
Of course, the rebellion is a deeper level.
Yeah, that's another way to put it. But I didn't mean to say the knowledge of God's gone. Absolutely. So that's a great question. I'm glad you said it. I'm glad you mentioned that. Go ahead. Let's go.
It seems that... evangelical Christianity has kind of aligned with conservatives to try to move back to this modernism and has really condemned the postmodernism and alienated the postmodern and the younger people. How can we actually communicate to them without alienating them or just merely condemning them?
Well, I mean, I'm going to keep going through. I'm going to say some things tonight about form and tomorrow night about content. So, I mean, the rest of my talks and the handout addresses that. But that's a really good point. There's a sense in which I believe that a lot of us, into their hands, I have to be careful of it, because they get these things. But, I mean, parents' generation were very moral people, but they were deists. They really didn't believe. That's the reason why for the deadness of the mainline churches. Even though they were filled in my parents' generation, there was still a tremendous deadness. And it worries me that evangelical Christians will ally with people like that who are nothing but theistic moralists. And I will talk about that tomorrow night. I mean, I think that is one of the biggest problems is that if Christians start to simply wave the banner of traditional values, you're really promoting a kind of old moral deism. So we have to be careful about that. Let me just, yeah, Steve, and get around a few others. Go ahead.
I have a question about the prevalence of postmodernities, like in the media, which blankets us like snow in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's pretty bad, isn't it?
some time ago,
pretty deep.
There was the commercial with Andre Agassi, which said, "Image is everything." Now, is that no accident, or is that?
No, it's no accident. That's just, you can see this stuff all the time. Image is everything.
And then was the MTV? I don't know why I can't stand it. But was the flashing images that change back and forth so quickly? Is that the same principle that there is?
Sure.
I mean, no truth, just pictures.
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone's in drag. I mean, in other words, it's how this relates. You know, I can't get it. You know, and Ozguinness and Peter Berger, these guys are sociologists. All I know about the sociology of knowledge is that it's not a nice, simple relationship that people in philosophy classes cook these things up and then they hand them to the media. But rather, there's something about the media itself. There's something about computers, and there's something about MTV, something about TV that kind of carries a particular, it sort of carries a philosophy and makes it more plausible. Even as the philosophy may give it content, so the form of the channel also seems to make it plausible too. And there's a kind of complex interrelationship. It's not a nice simple, you know, conspiracy between the these nasty people who are living in New Haven and cooking these things up and sending their orders down to MTV and HBO. It's nothing quite like that. But the answer is yes to everything you just said. A couple, you know, I haven't got anybody over here. A couple more over here, and then I'm going to have to keep going. Yeah.
I had a question about having worked with college students for 8 or 10 years. I had a little bit of success when I would talk to them about the law around compensation and try to balance and show them that.
It took a while, I'm sure.
It did.
Right. Yeah, I think that we'll get to that. All I say is that there are ways that I think you do have to do that. You know, the old R.C. Sproul approach, which was, and I've known R.C. for a long time. I learned apologetics on his floor, his living room floor, when he really was in Ligonier, you know, Ligonier, PA. And what he would do is, he's a classical apologist, so he would try to get to the proofs for God and the evidence. And we would say, you know what, a lot of people I know don't believe in proof and reason and all that. And he said, well, what you do then is you show them that they can't deny the law of non-contradiction without affirming it, which is basically what you do. In other words, you have to show them that as soon as you say, I don't believe in the law of non-contradiction, that is using it to try to deny it so you can't deny it. And he says, so you have to get it back on the playing field before you can move on. The problem is people are so far off the playing field that what they'll do is you can win a battle and lose the war. But just using that kind of terminology, they'll just sort of switch off and say, I want a milkshake, you know? And because you're after a person. So I would say that you do have to do that. I'm going to try to show you how to do it, but I wouldn't use those terms, that's all. I wouldn't bring the term up. And revel in the contradiction of it. Yes. Rejoice in the contradiction of it. Enjoy that. Enjoy the fact that they're affirming something to deny something. But so are you, you know. So kind of revel in the mud. Look, I'm dirty. I'm inconsistent. You know, so. Okay, one more. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask you something. Is there out on the horizon with the sociologists who are dealing with these space quakes? a mindset that says that this is only going to be for a decade, and you better start gearing up for something that's really underneath all of this quaking?
I hope so. I don't know. I mean, you mean the optimistic approaches? Well, it's just a lot of the stuff I'm talking about seems to be self-refuting, but you have to be careful. I don't know. I do know this kind. The only thing, I hope so, and it may be, but I'm a little worried about, too. I listened to the Lloyd-Jones sermon has had a big influence on me. He said, he was saying this kind only came out through fasting and prayer. This is not the same kind that we used to see. So let's not be too sanguine. Let's not be too optimistic. Let's say we really got to think, we got to pray like we've never prayed before. I'm a little afraid of saying, oh, things will be. Sometimes I read the stuff and I say, people are going to wake up and realize that you can't run a life like this. You can't run a country like this. This can't be done. Somebody's going to wake up and then they're going to be ripe as all get out because the older unbelief, which has been there for almost 200 years, has really been kind of smashed, and the new unbelief is so unstable that it's going to collapse and we're going to be... Now, if that happens, though, I'll tell you, here's the problem. It won't just be Christians who'll be there to mop up, but there'll be a lot of other cults and Islam and a lot of other things. So it could be. Time Magazine had a 2000... It had a special issue last year, I think it was. 21st Century, did anybody see it? And, you know, different editors wrote about what they thought the 21st century was going to bring in their field. Richard Ostling wrote the thing, who's a Christian, you know, wrote the thing for the 21st century in religion, and he said that he thought secularism would probably collapse and that people would become very religious, but there would be a tremendous amount of competition between the various sorts of religions, and there'd be a lot of new religions that we haven't heard of, which might therefore not mean that suddenly Christianity can just mop up. But he really does think that the atheism and that kind of non-belief in the non-spiritual is going to collapse, and that there will be revivals, but revivals of a lot of things. Let me at least start a little bit on the form. I want to just say, the next 10 minutes till 9 o'clock, I just want to do something on preaching. A couple things on what this means to preaching. So take a look at number 2, because I can get to the rest of it later. Well, I'll just say this under number 1. Number 1, you must start to expect secular people, no matter where you are, to actually be in church with you. And I put down here, no matter what part of the country you're from, no matter where you are, especially with the younger people, especially even with kids that have been raised in Christian homes, but if... one of the dangers is that the kids who are being homeschooled are being kept away from the acids of modernity and postmodernity. They're safe in a way, but they're probably also ineffective in the world, perhaps. The kids who have been raised in Christian homes and have been part of the culture, they've been in maybe public school, they've gone off to a major university, parents haven't shielded them from MTV and all that kind of stuff. They're very, very likely to have developed a grid anyway, a secular grid. And all I can say is that you need to start to expect people with very weird views, no matter what part of the country you're in, to be more and more in your church. I mean, to actually be there. Instead of saying, how are we going to get them? How are we going to reach them? You're going to find them in your midst. So anyway, but number 2, let me just say something about 4 or 5 things about preaching that I've been thinking about. This may seem odd, but I hope I can... the reason I'm careful about this is because I'm afraid a lot of what I'm talking about is preaching style. I'm not talking about expository preaching or non-expository or topical or any of that stuff. I really think that that's up to you. And I'm a little afraid to say the things I'm going to say because I taught preaching for 5 years at Westminster, and the worst sin is self-consciousness. The worst sin... of a preacher is to be watching yourself preaching instead of preaching. But sometimes you've got to go through periods where, though it's painful, you do kind of take a look at yourself and you think about it, and it might be a little awkward at first, but once you introduce the changes, they can become natural and then they become salutary. The first two have to be talked at together. Be gripped, be real. Now here's, I got to bring these things, these are very hard to keep together. Be gripped means that postmodern or secular people, whether they they probably never even heard the term. But they deconstruct. They get underneath. They say, this is just a show. What is this person really like? This is the reason for the cynicism of the media. Everybody said, hasn't everybody been amazed that the so-called liberal media has just demolished the Clinton administration? Because they deconstruct. They've been taught that. They've been taught underneath there really is, these people are just after power. There's no principle. There is no principle. It's all image. Everybody's after power. I'm after power. You're after power. And this is Nietzsche, you know. Get rid of the intellect, in comes the will. That's all there is. Get rid of reason, in comes the emotions. That's all there is. And as a result, they were just as nasty to a, quote, liberal administration as they were to the conservative administration in many ways. They deconstruct. They get underneath. People look at preachers, and the preacher cannot just be delivering an address. There has to be a passion. They want intensity. Now, do you see why I'm really walking on very thin ice? You can't just say, oh, okay. You can't say, oh, I need to be more intense. Well, my wife has been telling me that. No. Now, look. Now, just because postmodern people are sensitive to this, doesn't mean, just because they hate it, doesn't mean it's not wrong. Work that out, will you? See, you should have studied grammar better in third grade. The sermon, though well prepared, has to be born again. It has got to look like it's coming from you rather than from your notes. And, you know, and the best way for it not to look like it's coming from your notes is not to have it coming from your notes. Otherwise, you know, you're a hypocrite. The truth has to be dawning on you as you're doing it. I mean, you know, the way I used to feed my kids is very simple. My kids, you know, you'd feed when they were real little. I don't do this anymore. You know, you say, eat, the kids, mm-mm. So what do? You taste it yourself. You say, this is good, isn't it? And then, you know, and at least the more gullible kids will start to go, I like that. You have to taste this, what you're feeding the people at the time. The people have to sense that it's dawning on you as you speak. If you are thinking, what's the next point? Let's see, this is the second point. What's the third point? If you're watching yourself preach instead of preaching, I just think the secular audience will see that right away. And there has to be a sense. This is what's so weird. They hate soullessness. That's odd, is it not? But they do. They like Letterman over Jay Leno. They do. They are happier to have disorder, as long as it's spontaneous, rather than something that's methodical and passionless. Now, having said that, I just told you that the most dangerous thing for you to do is to say, okay, I guess I just have to get a little louder or something. Boy, I put down here two things. The only way for you to become more of a gripped person. Now, some of you have no trouble with that, but you're going to have trouble with the next one. But anyway. The way to become a gripped person is to meditate and reflect over your material in private until you at least weep or get mad at somebody or something. And the other thing is to virtually memorize your stuff, I think, so that you know it so well that you don't really need the notes. So that when you get up there, you're able to do variations on the theme because you know the theme so well that you're not having to reach for the information. You know the information so cold that when a new idea comes, you're not afraid to introduce it. And David Martin Lloyd-Jones used to write out his manuscripts, or he would write out a detailed outline. And what he did was in the morning, three times before he got to church, he read through that thing. Now, the way to read through it is not just, he didn't write his sermon out word for word, most of us don't, but he preached it in his mind word for word, which meant that to go through it three times, at least the first time was a little, it would take longer to go through it in your mind than it would be to preach it. The second time would be just about right, and the third time would be a little bit less. You're kind of, at that point, you're reviewing. The only other thing he would do is he would look at the main headings of his notes during the announcement time, right before he would get up to preach. During the announcements, he felt like, I don't have to worship right now. And he would look the thing through. And then he would get up and preach. And at that point, he said, he would not need the stuff. That he knew it well enough, he knew it cold enough, even though that took a good 3 hours in the morning before he got there. that he was able to kind of, you know, hear the spirit at the moment and introduce. I have found over the years that that works for me. And I think that helps being gripped, frankly. Now, you got to like what you're saying, and if you don't know it. But now, look, on the next page, top of the next page. Now, this may not quite look like these are opposed, but they actually, there's a tension between these. The second thing, be gripped, you know, intense, be real. Now, here's the other weird thing for postmodern audiences. It almost seems like a contradiction, but secular audiences also want a preacher to be laid back. They want it to be conversational. They do not want to hear that this guy's voice and intonation is different publicly than privately. Now, I found that in the evangelical subculture, there is ministerial tones that in the evangelical subculture send signals of authority that in the rest of the world do not. In fact, they send very different signals. And this isn't that easy for some of us who've come out of traditions in which you adopt a style, but I'm just wondering about this. Now, you know, again, I have to be very careful because this is just could be a white thing. It may not be a black or Hispanic thing or an Asian thing. I don't know. I know that black, Hispanic, and Asian preaching is a lot more stylized from what I can tell than white preaching. But I'm just telling you what I'm finding personally is that, and this is what here's where you have the tension. If you're too gripped, a person can start to say, I can't relate to that. You know, the guy's not there talking to me and reasoning with me and talking to me personally. He's all kind of lifted up and caught up, and I just, you know, he doesn't seem to have any doubts or he doesn't seem to have any problems himself. You know? And that's why I put down here, this is a hard balance, because many preachers who think they're personal are just folksy and they're not gripped. And others who are very intense are not personal, and they make themselves almost too remote and lofty. Now, how do you say, well, how can you be real? I think the answer to that is to think about it. At that point, you really almost have to ask a few people, do I take on a ministerial tone? Do I take on a sing-songness? But, now here goes, skip the note number one for a minute. Number three, C, is very related to the other two. Be dialogical. Now, by the way, in black churches, they're already dialogical. So this is for you white folks, which most of you are. Modern people are used to interactive mediums. It's important that you carry on a conversation with them. You have to know their questions and difficulties so well. Now, see, this really relates very much to being real, that you are able to pose them their problems, their objections, their difficulties. In other words, when you say something, you need to know their hearts well enough to know what a Christian, a non-Christian, and a sort of Twilight Zone Christian, the sorts of things that people say about that. You need to express their doubts, their fears, you need to articulate their doubts and their fears and their hopes and their problems in a way that is as good as they could do it, if not better. So they could say, yeah, that's how I feel too. You have to sometimes ask direct questions and then pause and not be afraid, especially those of you in white churches, if occasionally people answer. But, just don't let that bother you. The point is, there has to be a sort of dialogical feel between you and the folks. And you have to grant whatever degree of merit their objections have. You have to show utter respect. In fact, you know, you have to admit, I think you don't have to say it this way, though I sometimes do. You have to say, you know, I understand unbelief. You know, it's just that unbelief, I'd be an unbeliever too, except unbelief creates more problems, there's more incoherences, there's more difficulties in unbelief than belief. In other words, I understand unbelief quite a bit. The fact of the matter is it takes a lot more, I think, unbased faith to be an unbeliever than it does to be a believer. Sometimes you have to actually say, the reason I'm a Christian is because, yeah, I got problems with Christianity. There's a lot of things about Christianity that don't make sense, but every alternative is far more incoherent, far more difficult, creates far more inconsistencies, creates far bigger difficulty. Of course I got problems. You got far worse problems if you're not a Christian. And see, to say something like that, very often people can say, oh my gosh, here's somebody I can relate to. I mean, here's somebody who seems to understand unbelief does make sense to a certain degree. That's what I mean by being dialogical. D, almost done for the night, be Catholic. Now, this comes close to what I was, my brother over here, I was trying to say something to you about this. I'm using this term in the way we understand it as Reformed people when we say the Apostles' Creed. Catholic means the common ground we share with all Christians. It means to have a Catholic spirit means you're generous, you have to turn a page with me, to Christians of other persuasions by dwelling on strengths, showing them, and even non-Christians respect when you disagree with them. Modern people who are very sensitive to culture are going to take very ill to you bashing Christians who are not quite where you are and people who are not quite where you are. If you're after Catholics, you're after Pentecostals, you're after President Clinton and so on. Here's, look at this. Keep a humble and moderate tone when talking about anything except sin, cross, new birth, sovereignty, and holiness of God. At that point, you get totally intemperate. But every other place, you got to be temperate, because you could be wrong about all these other things. You know, the Catholic spirit means you say, hey, look, you know, the 80% of the doctrine that I have is shared with all is Orthodox Catholic and all the other Protestant Christians. 80% of what I believe is shared by all these other Christians. That's where I'm going to be absolutely immoderate. Everywhere else, be very moderate, because they can smell people who are, you know, as a Reformed person, I believe 100 things. And, you know, a good 50 of them, nobody else but Reformed people, you know, only Reformed people share them with me. I'm going to dwell on the first 50 things, not the last 50 things. I need to, because people are going to smell power play. And you need to be, and by the way, people aren't really very liberal or conservative anymore if you've looked carefully. In spite of the fact that there are activists on the ends pushing, people are very, very, very non-ideological. They're getting more so. They realize that the left and the right have, you know, we've tried fascism, we tried communism, and they utterly failed. That's the left and the right. The people are starting to say, you know what, maybe, hey, somewhere they would like some moderation. Be practical, which means, now tomorrow night I'll talk about the danger of pragmatism. For now, the best proof, and Preston actually referred to this, I think, the best proof for postmodern people. Now, it better not be the only proof. It's the only proof they want, and you can't give them only that proof. But the best proof for postmodern people about the truth of a principle is, does it work? They're pragmatists, okay? Christianity is utterly pragmatic. It's not pragmatistic. It's not pragmatism. We'll talk about the difference, but I feel like we're so afraid sometimes of being pragmatists that we don't at least show people how it applies. And I personally think that you do your doctrine, then you do your application just in the old Puritan way. You just have to get to your application pretty quick. Okay? You need to get to your application. John Frame says, you don't understand a text unless you understand how it applies. Right? You've heard that? John Frame says, it's not like first you understand the text and then you see how it applies. If you don't see how it applies, you don't understand it. Because of the unity, you see, of being and doing before the covenant Lord. There's, you know, it says in Deuteronomy 29:29, he says, the secret things have been that God has not told us, God belongs to God. But what he has revealed, he's revealed that you may do it. Which means there's nothing in the Bible just to be known. Nothing God reveals except that which is to be done. So there is a pragmatism about Christianity, and for postmodern people, you got to get to it. What does it make a difference? And I even have a little list here. If you see in the middle of E, I think about these things. Pride, lust, worry, greed, prejudice, resentment, self-consciousness, depression, fear, and guilt. Those are sins. And here's circumstances. Loneliness, persecution, weariness, grief, sickness, failure, indecision, confusion, physical handicap, old age, disillusionment, boredom. Hey, now you can take any text and go down the list of those 20 things and say, what does this text have to say to how many of these? One, two, three, or four? Make sure that you ask practical questions of the text so that you can show people what difference it makes to them. Last of all, say, be vivid. And by being vivid, you do have to adapt a little bit to the fact we have a visual culture, not a logical culture. And I think one of the ways to do that is to preach like Jonathan Edwards or Charles Spurgeon. That means, our culture is becoming more of a sight and sound culture, less of a reading culture. And therefore, it's more important than ever to engage people's imaginations when you preach. Much more important than ever. Now, what's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with that. And does that mean you have to tell lots of stories? A lot of guys do that. And I probably could tell more stories than I do. But I'm not after just that. I'm after sense appeal. So, for example, look at down here. When Edward says, your good deeds cannot earn a place in heaven, he never stops like that. He always goes on and says, no more than a spider web can stop a falling rock. Now, that's not a story, but you've engaged the senses. I mean, that's very vivid, is it not? You know, you have a big falling rock and a spider web, the poor helpless spider web. Is it your good deeds are no more, they are no more effective at keeping you, getting you to heaven, keeping you out of hell than a spider web stopped a falling rock. He just thought like that. He thought concretely. And you've got to talk like that. You've got to talk like that. And it doesn't necessarily mean stories. One of the problems with stories, of course, is they can just take up so much time that the trouble with stories is very often they're not application or doctrine. But last thing of all, go back to the page where I said I skipped note number one. It's hard to stay gripped and be real. It's hard to seem very personal and conversational and pretty much the way you'd be in private, at the same time to be intense. The fact is you can say things in public that you could never get away with. It would be way too intense in private. But somehow to pull the two things together is pretty hard. I think it's a biblical ideal. I put down here, if you want to see the difference between a modern preacher and a postmodern preacher, you need to watch the old Henry V movie of the 1940s with Laurence Olivier playing Henry V. And the new Henry V movie, 1989 I think it was, with Kenneth Branagh. Utterly different. Same words. Utterly different. And the more I looked at those two things, the more I realized how different. Olivier's style was high and noble and lofty, he declaimed. And he was great. He was great. But you couldn't relate to him, but you didn't want to, because the modern age was the age of great men, you see. And it was the older humanism, very idealistic about human nature, very traditional in its habits, wanted to keep its morality and still get rid of religion, you know. That was an unstable compound, obviously. It took 200 years to fall apart, but there it went. Kenneth Branagh style, much less emotional control, and yet he's both gripped and yet much more real. He can relate to him. It's still Shakespeare in English. I mean, you know, what's so weird about it when you watch it is it's still Shakespeare. Shakespeare in English is not much like what we're used to. And yet there's a transparency, there's an intimacy, yet there's an intensity. Very human, extremely human. And I think Phyllis Brooks was right in saying preaching is truth through personality. That's what Jesus brought. Jesus was truth in a human form. And so the whole idea of incarnation brought to bear on preaching is probably more important than it's ever been. The word's got to become flesh in a way it didn't used to have to be. Vividness, practical, gripped, yet very real. The word's got to become flesh in a way that it didn't used to have to be. You know, you could use the ministerial tone. You know, you could declaim. You could be lofty. You could be great. You could be erudite. And everybody said, great, we've got a minister like that. Isn't that wonderful? We've got a doctor. You know, we've got somebody who can really preach up a storm. No more. They don't care. So be more like Kenneth Branagh than Laurence Olivier. Go get the movies out. Watch them. I'm serious. Watch them and see what I mean. And you get an idea. Okay, I'm going to close in prayer. And because we pick up right back tomorrow night and we have a whole hour, all that, we'll be able to have more time for questions. Okay, let's pray. Thank you, Father, for showing us that though this kind is hard, your Son casts out all kinds. Your Son casts out all kinds. Maybe we can't. But we do look and realize that there's the kind that come out with prayer and fasting. There's a kind that comes out with a lot more thought, a lot more dependence on you, obviously. We pray that as we move in really to a new era of mission, at least here in this country and maybe elsewhere as well, that you would show us that it's not handouts and it's really not Henry V movies and it's not techniques, but it really is. Turning to you and fasting and prayer, and knowing that the knowledge of you is still in people, that you're still a sovereign God, you're still an electing God, you're still a God who calls people from the dead to life, And we pray that you will just show us what is the right way for us to still be part of that great kingdom program. Make us good stewards of your word. Teach us how to make the word flesh. Teach us how to know and exegete our culture and our world as well as the word. Make us wise as serpents, innocent as doves. Make us, like, in short, like your son. In his name we pray. Amen.
Well, there you have it. About 75 minutes of apologetics gold from Dr. Keller, who we lost this past Friday, May 19th, after a bit of a protracted battle with pancreatic cancer. Certainly, we want to keep his wife, Kathy, and their children in our prayers. You know, the beautiful thing about death for someone like Dr. Keller is he is in the arms and in the presence of his Savior, Jesus Christ. And that is something that we all long for and hope for. We certainly feel the sorrow of loss. That's a real thing that we experience as part of the human condition. And yet, the other beauty of Dr. Keller's life is he leaves us not just with the sorrow of his passing, but with the legacy of all that he has written and all that he has done to equip pastors. He's written wonderful books on a variety of topics. The Reason for God, which is an apologetics masterpiece. Every Good Endeavor, which talks about the importance of vocational discipleship. Ministries of Mercy, which talks really about how the church plays an important role in delivering mercy and justice to those who need it. He also wrote with his wife, Kathy, just a fantastic book called The Meaning of Marriage, which really does talk about how do two people come together in marriage in a Christ-honoring way, that it really kind of goes beyond some of our stereotypical understandings of a husband and wife relationship, but in a beautiful, beautiful picture. But the other thing that Dr. Keller leaves behind are the hundreds, if not thousands, of pastors that he influenced, including myself, who have been able to kind of drink from his well and to develop a way of leaning in to the world, of offering foretastes of Christ's coming kingdom to those around us, of speaking into cultural and political conversations in a way that is not only winsome, but points to Christ. And so we are so thankful for the opportunity to be able to share that snippet from Dr. Keller's lengthy corpus of ministry teaching. We are really, really excited about what's coming in the future. We will be back with you next week. Thank you so much to Nicole Ritgers, our ministry resident, for all of the work that she does, cleaning up these podcasts, making me sound not just intelligent, but coherent and clear. Very thankful for her. Look forward to seeing you again, or at least look forward to speaking to you again next week. This is Michael Langer saying, "And now may our Father in heaven make you one as he and his Son are one, so that the world will know that he loves them and sent his Son for them. Go in peace."